For antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. Our guest today is Wayne White. He's an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute and former deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia. Welcome to the show, sir.
My pleasure.
Nice to talk to you. Now, before we get to Iran, which is the topic all week this week on Anti-War Radio, I figured we could talk a little bit about the Bush press conference that just ended. I know you just saw it as well. And it seemed to me pretty clear that as far as Iraq goes, Bush is still absolutely determined and apparently honestly believes that it's possible and necessary for the Maliki government to succeed in Iraq, for there to be a multi-ethnic single state over that country, and that it will be able to work. Last week, however, the Council on Foreign Relations released a report that said that it was far too late for this. So I wonder, sir, being an Iraq analyst at the State Department's intelligence agency, formerly, what your perspective on this debate is.
Yeah, I headed the Iraq intelligence team for my last 2 years in government until 05 at State. I'm much closer to the Council of Foreign Relations on this. I think a mistake that's consistently made by the administration, and I saw it again in the press conference, which just occurred, is taking what people in the Maliki government, Maliki himself, others, as what they say as being ground truth, as the military calls it. In other words, they say they're going to do this, and therefore this is great. But they're always saying they're going to do something, and their ability to deliver on promises over the last several years, whether it's the Maliki government, Jafari before him, Iyad Alawi before him, the track record has been an utter failure to be able to extend governance in Iraq to the point where you can actually get a handle on many of its serious problems.
Right. Now, you've written before that were Iraq to break into pieces as Yugoslavia did, that the results would just be horrible with the various ethnicities and religious differences, people stuck on the quote-unquote wrong side of the lines. What do you think is going to happen?
Oh, it would be if civil war breaks out in Iraq, and there is a debate over the issue of civil war. You know, is there one? Is there not one? I have a high bar. I don't think there is one right now. But the only reason there isn't one is because we're there separating the parties, the fact that the sectarian strife there has gotten so severe that some people are calling this a civil war just shows the extent, you know, of the bloodletting that's going on. But to get back to your question, one problem we have in Iraq is that probably 20 to 25% of the inhabited area of the country, much of it's desert and uninhabited, is mixed. And so in any kind of civil war which is based on ethno-sectarian lines, we're going to have these mixed areas become heavily contested. It's already happening in Baghdad. In fact, Baghdad, thoroughly mixed and containing one-third of the population of the country, is the poster child, you know, for this kind of problem. And sure enough, the Shia militias in Baghdad have been doing their level best to empty the city of Sunni Arabs, either by, you know, putting notes under the door that they're going to be killed if they don't leave within the next 48 hours, or better still, killing them outright. And a civil war would probably begin, if we weren't there to separate the parties, with the Shia militias, Kurdish Peshmerga, which is their version of a militia, but a little more legal, and the overwhelmingly Shia and Kurdish army sweeping virtually every mixed area in the country of Sunni Arabs.
Well, if you agree with the Council on Foreign Relations that it's too late for Maliki to create a multi-ethnic government and hold the country together, and also that if we leave, full-scale war will break out, what do you suggest?
Well, unfortunately, I'm going to suggest withdrawal. And it's the same thing that I said to Soledad O'Brien on CNN American Morning in early December when she asked the same question. And I am fully aware, as a Middle East expert, of the very serious consequences of withdrawal, as were so many people in the Iraq study group I was part of. But as I said to Soledad, to paraphrase Churchill on democracy, withdrawal is the worst possible option, except for all the others.
Right.
Many people opposing withdrawal are opposing it on the mistaken belief that by staying, we can prevent those consequences from happening. A lot of us believe that, no, we're just going to stay there, bleed more, lose more money, and then leave anyway with the same consequences.
Right, and now you've written, or were quoted at least in one place, as saying you don't believe that the civil war, when we do leave and it breaks out, you don't believe that it will spread outside of Iraq. Is that right still?
I you can't say anything with and be definitive, and I wish I had nuanced that slightly. But, yeah, largely I don't believe it will spread outside of Iraq. I think it will probably mimic, to some degree, the Spanish Civil War of the 1930s, in which it gets just like hell inside of the country, and with outside powers pouring in munitions and money to aid various parties, probably, of course, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and perhaps Egypt as well, pouring in money and assistance to the Sunni Arabs to prevent them all being driven into Jordan and Syria in the face of what I described before. And then Iran, of course, quite predictably, backing up the Shia in Iraq and feeding them arms, money, and what have you to hold up their end of the deal. And so you could actually have a severe amount of fighting inside of the country with tens of thousands, you know, killed without it necessarily spilling across the borders, because the parties involved, particularly in supporting the Sunni Arabs, would be providing that aid in order to keep it from spreading back across their border. So as long as they can keep the Sunni Arabs inside of Iraq from being rolled by Shia, that will prevent millions of Sunni Arabs fleeing into areas west and southwest of the country, much as they are now, with already over 2 million Sunni Arabs and Christians. Iraqi Christians in Syria and Jordan.
Now, when you bring up Iran arming the militias, certainly that's already happening, and yet there seems to be a point of confusion, particularly in the last couple of weeks here, that the government is saying that the Iranians are arming the Shiite militias with these new high-tech roadside bombs, basically, and that these are what are killing American soldiers, and yet I've been under the impression for almost 4 years now that the American soldiers are fighting the Sunni insurgency, and only in smaller isolated cases have they warred against the Shiites at all. I'm thinking the battles in Najaf in 2004. But since then, the Shiites basically are the government that the United States is backing. So I was wondering if you could help clear up for me whether it's correct that the Iranians are killing American soldiers with these bombs.
These are really good points. You've really done your homework. I can't clear up all of this, but I can put some perspective on it. First of all, I believe the president, even though he can't pronounce Quds, it's Quds force, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's Dirty Tricks force, I believe that they are feeding these munitions into the country. One reason they would do it is to provide Shia militias a formidable defensive weapon should we try to take them on, such as in the context of a surge. But as you observe, I'm not speaking to how we're losing people to these things. I find this very perplexing because numbers of casualties have been thrown up and that have resulted from these munitions. And as you correctly point out, we haven't been fighting Shia militias since we had two flare-ups with Muqtada al-Sadr way back in 04, just as these things were beginning to appear, not when they were really, you know, around. And so the government's got a little explaining to do. How do we lose these people? Because if we did lose the numbers they're talking about, it was undoubtedly to Sunni Arab insurgents, which means these have made their way into the hands of the Sunni Arab insurgents. And that raises another question as to, well, would the Iranians give Sunni Arab insurgents who loathe Iran this kind of thing? And it's not as simple as it might appear.
Well, I think your first explanation seems much more plausible, that they're arming the Shiites for the eventuality if America turns on them, rather than they've been arming the Sunnis all along.
Right. The one thing that has to be said, though, is that sometimes the lines aren't as clear as they appear. I was looking at one of the pictures in their show, and it was an Iran. It was a government security vehicle from a special unit that had been hit in this in the town of Hilla, which is deep in the Shia south. So here was a Shia, probably a Shia perpetrator hitting, you know, a government vehicle of a unit that was probably largely Shia. And so there has been some Shia-on-Shia militia, you know, violence, and to the extent you give this stuff to them, they can use it on each other. But that still doesn't get to the U.S. forces aspect of this. And let me just say two things, and I don't know this, whether this is true or not, I'm just throwing out two things. The Quds Force, which means Jerusalem Force, this elite, dirty tricks unit of the Revolutionary Guard, is viciously anti-American and very bloody-minded. And sometimes things just don't make sense. They like killing Americans, quite frankly, and I would not completely rule out the fact that they have slipped some of these things to Sunni Arab insurgents. And second, Muqtada al-Sadr, I learned this when I was still doing my intelligence, Muqtada al-Sadr has been in touch with Sunni Arab insurgents, which also seems like a bad fit. But this is true.
Particularly at the beginning of the war, right? During the first Battle of Fallujah, he sent fighters to go up and help.
Right, right. And he maintained contacts after that. Not because he liked them, but because they shared his anti-occupation agenda. Could he have slipped them some of these? Perhaps. So the lines aren't quite as clear, and I find it rather hard to sort out. But I do believe that the Quds Force has been, you know, moving this stuff, you know, into the country, and in fact, mostly very cleverly. The president talks about hunting down these people, you know, the Quds Force implicitly that's doing this, when in fact, I don't think there are too many of them in the country. The Iranians, judging from some of the accounts I've read, are rather smart about all this. You come to the border and get the weapons. We don't deliver. Keeping their people to a minimum,
sure,
you know, inside of the country, which is why, despite all of the great ballyhoo about, you know, the Iranian involvement in Iraq, what do we pick up? Five Iranians.
Right.
That isn't very much.
And they're at Skiri headquarters, and Skiri is the most powerful American-backed faction in Iraq. So.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Now, I should bring this up as long as we're talking about this. I really appreciate your perspective. I had just dismissed this outright, honestly, particularly when last Friday the Los Angeles Times reported that Condoleezza Rice, Robert Gates, and even Stephen Hadley had sent this intelligence back to the cook because it wasn't good enough. And I thought, you know, when Stephen Hadley is sending intelligence back to the cook, there's something terribly wrong with it.
Yeah. I've heard three versions of what happened last week, and I don't know which one to believe. One version was, and it didn't have personalities attached to it, save one of the ones you mentioned, said this isn't good enough, we need to do it over right. And it wasn't so much, this is the way I heard it, it wasn't so much that the information wasn't good, it was the presentation, the way it was being put forward, how much of it was going to be released, was not going to be very convincing. That was version one that I heard. And then version two that I heard was that there were people in the government, particularly in the intelligence community, that did not want a briefing at all. And remember, the briefing was supposed to be here in Washington, not out there. And if it had been done in Washington, it probably wouldn't have been anonymous and in this very squirrely, you know, manner that was chosen for the delivery. But I can't rule out a compromise between the people who wanted to do it and the people who wanted no briefing at all. And it was like, okay, well, you don't want it done, so we'll do it out there, and we'll do it anonymously behind closed doors. And I've seen strange compromises in my time in government, particularly over release of intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you bring up the presentation, they didn't like the presentation. That makes me wonder whether this was drawn up by CIA analysts or by Abram Shulsky and his buddies in the Iranian Directorate at the Pentagon.
Well, I don't know where it was drawn up, although I found it so ironic, so odd, that people weren't allowed to take pictures during the briefing when, in fact, people on a large chat room that I participate in have sent me a link to the entire briefing. I've got all the slides. I've got the entire thing, you know, on a link, so that's kind of odd. But anyway, I try to maintain a few contacts inside the government, and I get the impression that on the one fact, Quds Force, which is part of the Iranian government, supplying this stuff into Iraq, is true. And that I didn't want to believe me, because I, as you know from what you've read, am very concerned about a major attack against Iran in the context of the nuclear infrastructure there, and the concerns over possible nuclear weapons program. And I'm the last person who wants to add more to the Iranian, you know, case, or a possible case for war against Iran. But the information I'm getting is that part was true.
Although, again, I'd just like to reiterate, I believe you did say, though, it remains to be shown that these are being used in vast numbers by the Sunni insurgency against the Americans, for example.
Well, given the casualties that I saw, you know, the casualties previously I said were significant enough to demand an explanation as to how they were making their way to Sunni Arab insurgents, because I don't think Shia could have inflicted these casualties, since, you know, the only casualties that were significant are old ones,
mm-hmm.
like you said. But then we flip to the other side, then you have another view of that, you know, that casualty figure, you know, which is that it isn't that high given the aggregate of casualties overall in this conflict. But it's in the context of these munitions, it's significant.
Sure.
In another sense.
Right. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Wayne White. He's the former head of the Iraq desk at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research. That's their CIA, basically. And, sir, I first found your name in this Reuters article from January the 19th, where I believe, contrary to everything I'd read before, you said, quote, "We're not talking just surgical strikes against an array of targets inside Iran. We're talking about clearing a path to the targets." And the article is headlined, "U.S. Plans Envision Broad Attack on Iran." And so I'd like to ask you about that. You say that the plan includes taking out much of the Iranian Air Force, their Kilo submarines, anti-ship missiles. So this isn't the proposal for airstrikes against Iran is not just to hit the Natanz and Bushehr nuclear facilities, but to hit basically their entire infrastructure or military infrastructure. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding, and I'm glad you didn't. Misread that Reuter piece in repeating one glitch in it, which was that I just saw this, or, you know, these are new. The plans have been oozing out in a series of leaks since last winter. And Cy Hirsch, in fact, has been most aggressive in, you know, pointing out, you know, the fact that these plans exist. And yes, as I understand it, we're talking a huge package of airstrikes. I mean, we're talking in the neighborhood of, say, 1,500 combat sorties by aircraft and launches of cruise missiles against various targets. And this would involve tactical aircraft in theater. This would involve carrier battle groups. Would probably also involve strategic air assets coming from Diego Garcia. And so it would be very, very robust. Why? Because if the Iranians are hit, they're going to hit back. They're not going to go crawl away and lick their wounds. And that's why you get into the effort to eliminate their retaliatory capabilities in the Gulf, which includes anti-ship missiles, surface-to-surface missiles that could be used to attack commercial shipping or American fleet elements. And by the way, there's a lot of these things, and they're on the islands near the Strait of Hormuz, on the coastal areas near the Strait of Hormuz, the Kila-class submarines, which could attack, although they're not too hard to detect, you just can't let them, operate. And then Iran has something I didn't bother mentioning because some people think it's funny. Iran, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, has a very sizable fleet of speedboats. And I don't mean, 12-foot, thing that you water ski, behind. We're talking speedboats that some of them are 30 or 40 feet, long, more like a World War II PT boat or something larger, that can deliver missiles and other weaponry. And they have been training rigorously on swarming tactics, knowing full well that a lot of them are going to get shot up before they reach the target. They have adopted swarming tactics against merchant shipping or even our fleet elements that they would try undoubtedly under this scenario and would have to be dealt with. Another thing that isn't mentioned in that article is that Iran has a medium-range and ballistic missile arsenal. And I cannot believe that if we were going in, we wouldn't have tried to take that out. And her medium-range missile fleet, mainly variants of the Scud series, enhanced-range Scuds, we call them Scud Cs, things like that. They have several hundred of these, and they're not all in one place. And so we would probably try to knock these out. Much of this not only aimed at trying to protect shipping and protect our own fleet from retaliation, but protect our Gulf Cooperation Council allies from retaliation.
So when UPI Chief Arnaud de Bourgrave says he believes there's a plan in the works to hit as many as 700 targets, he's lowballing. That's a low estimate to you.
Well, he may not be lowballing. Actually, 700 targets may actually be, roughly accurate.
And so the 1,500 sorties would be redundancy to make sure that the targets are all destroyed.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. You have to be prepared to revisit targets. And this is where it gets very dangerous. I mean, when you really get down in where the rubber meets the road, you're talking about a robust air campaign that could stretch out over several days, I've heard even almost a week. Well, what are the Iranians doing with the things you haven't eliminated on day one or day two or day three? They know it's a use or lose, situation.
Right. Or even at the end of the week.
Excuse me?
Even at the end of the week, I spoke with former CIA agent Philip Giraldi yesterday, who said, what are we going to do after a week? We're going to say, okay, we're done bombing you. War's over now?
Ah, that's the great one. Oh, this is great, Scott. That's the problem. There's no end game, to this thing. The presumption is, well, that's it. The Iranians lost.
Well, Hirsch has reported that he calls them the Kool-Aid drinkers, the neoconservatives who are pushing this policy, that they believe still, cynically, that the Iranian people will be bombed into overthrowing their government and installing an America-friendly government.
I know,
they'll blame their government for getting them bombed.
We have a great historical precedent for this. When I was the Iraq analyst, as opposed to a division chief over the Iraq account and what have you, back in from 1979-86, I covered the Iran-Iraq War. And it started because a deluded dictator thought he could punch the Iranians in the nose, grab territory, and pound the Iranians, and not only force the Iranian regime to call it quits after he had, overrun significant pieces of territory along the border in order to get it back, but also so humiliate the Khomeini regime that it might actually be overthrown. Just the opposite happened. The Iranian public, swallowing hard in some cases because they were not, revolutionaries, swallowing hard and grimly determined, rallied around the Iranian government and grimly fought through 8 years of war against Iraq and would have fought to 10 years unless the Iraqis had acquired enough weaponry to finally force the Iranians, you know, into a situation where they were losing so much they had to finally call it quits.
And that was at the cost of millions of Iranian lives, wasn't it?
Probably about a million. But if we're talking about Saddam, who started it under the delusion that the Iranians would overthrow their government. The Iraqis suffered anywhere between 150 and 250,000 casualties, and saw their budget—their huge foreign currency reserves completely depleted, and racked up $80 billion in debt. You know, beyond that, in fact, became so debt-ridden that it led to other developments, such as the Kuwait War, after Saddam couldn't shake the Kuwaitis down for money to help, you know, pay for all this.
Right.
But anyway, here we face a situation where somebody under the same delusion went into Iraq and Iran, and we saw how Iranians reacted. And quite frankly, we're already seeing shades of how the Iranians would react in the present. Iranians did the same thing.
There was a massive rally just the other day in favor of their nuclear program, right?
Well, exactly. If we hit them, you have not hit the regime. You've hit Iran.
Right.
Iranians are proud, they're nationalistic, and they would rally around their government. It would make that regime that much stronger. In fact, as we have ratcheted up our anti-Iranian rhetoric, starting with the Axis of Evil speech formulation in the 2002 State of the Union address, we have seen American popularity levels in Iran in very reputable polling consistently falling and falling and falling. Believe it or not, before that speech, a majority of Iranians had a positive view of the United States.
Well, I remember very well that after September 11th, I believe on the night of September 11th, immediately everybody went outside, maybe it was the next day in Tehran, whatever, but immediately after the September 11th attacks, there was a candlelight vigil where a million people showed up in Tehran.
Yeah. You won't see that now.
No, certainly not.
No. In fact, the Arab, our numbers in the Arab world have been, for many, many years, very, very bad. This administration has made them much worse.
Mm-hmm.
But the Iranian numbers were in stark contrast to Arab world numbers. They're still better, but they're much, much worse than before the State of the Union with the Axis of Evil comments, and continuing to slide further and further down because of developments since then. And so anybody who thinks that the Iranian regime is going to be overthrown as a result of a major military attack by the United States is delusional.
Okay, now another possible consequence of this war is, as Hirsch reported a year ago in his article, The Iran Plans, one of his sources said that if America bombs Iran, the south of Iraq will go up like a candle, that Basra could be taken with 10 imams and one sound truck.
Actually, I thought it was that the Iranians, an Iranian official said that we did take Basra talking about how they undermine British rule in the south. But whatever context that exists in, this is the penultimate problem with attacking Iran. If you succeeded in severely reducing their retaliatory options in the Gulf, in other words, they didn't have much to fire back with even after day one. I doubt that. But anyway, even if you did that, all that does is make Iran look more to Iraq, you know, as the place for payback. And you would have already enraged Shia in Iraq over Iran being attacked, who probably would engage in anti-American and anti-British acts without any direction, you know, whatsoever. You might even have the Maliki government, in fact, in very, very severe straits with respect to its credibility if it continued to maintain the relationship it has now with the United States. But worse, whereas there probably are almost no Iranian Revolutionary Guard elements inside of Iraq for the reasons, you know, that we discussed before, the Iranians could pour hundreds of Iranian Revolutionary Guards, could force elements into Iraq and take revenge right there. and there may well be plenty of Shia who would be delighted to hide them and guide them to targets. We could suffer cruelly in Iraq. The place is a mess already, and an attack on Iran would make it a lot worse.
Well, and Abdulaziz Hakim, the head of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, and Muqtada al-Sadr have both said that if America attacks Iran, they will go to war in the south. And again, that is the government of Iraq that we are training and equipping every day.
Well, Sadr's people, I'm sure, would. They would. There are fractures in his organization, and so it's hard to talk about that organization as a monolithic. I'm not saying you did, but some people do. But even if Sadr tried to sit on them, knowing that he might suffer and others by the U.S. in such a scenario, there are elements of the Jaish al-Mahdi, the Mahdi army, which would absolutely lunge out at us. There would be no question, about that at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure you're aware that Newsweek is reporting that they believe a third carrier strike force is on its way. And in the same paragraph, or I guess the preceding paragraph, they quote a Bush administration national security officer, retired now or former, named Hillary Mann, saying she believes that the policy is to provoke and provoke and provoke until Iran finally hits us, and then we can act like it's self-defense when we initiate this war. Does that sound plausible to you?
Well, the more you send out there, the more danger there is of miscalculation. Some colleagues of mine have actually, been very concerned in writing about that, and I am too. I think the Iranians will do everything they can to sit on their hands to avoid that, provocation. What I worry about is the more you build up forces, out there in the region, the more I worry about the fact that we're proceeding with our plan, to go after the Iranians.
Well,
and
my
feeling is that this president believes that only he would do this. That, in other words, come 20 January 2009, the window will close, and he would have no faith that a Republican or Democratic successor would be, vernacular oriented, would have the balls to go through with, this kind of thing, when in fact I might think instead to have the stupidity of going through with this sort of thing. And so he feels it's his mission, it's on his watch, and he takes very seriously, we're told, the existential threat to Israel that an Iranian nuclear weapons capability would pose.
And again, this is Wayne White. He's the former head of the Iraq desk at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, obviously very well informed about Iran as well. Do you believe that they're anywhere near the ability to create a nuclear weapon?
No. Everyone seems to be pretty well on the same page, except the Israelis. Israelis, when I was in government, consistently hyped. If we thought something was, going to develop within 3 or 4 years, they thought it was one or two, if it was an Arab weapons system or something else. But they're out there, it's in their face, and they have to be more pessimistic,
Well, even Meir Dagan,
but prepare for the worst. But no, I think most people are on the same page with respect to Iran, that Iran is 3 to 8 years away from, acquiring a nuclear weapon. So there is time to play with, but the trouble is, if this president is as determined as I fear he might be to get this job done, figuring no one else will, the 3 to 8 years don't matter to him. The only thing that matters is the remainder of his presidency.
Right.
He feels he has that much time to get the job done.
Yep. Okay. And now, I guess finally, I'll let you go here, but I wanted to ask you real quickly, in Ken Silverstein's thing at Harper's, you're the most optimistic person there, who says that perhaps the Iranians will go ahead and suspend their enrichment before the February 21st United Nations deadline, and perhaps this thing can be avoided. I guess as a kind of adjunct question to that, I kind of have the idea, which I would like to believe in, that George Bush is basically just doing his best Richard Nixon impression, which is to send Henry Kissinger out there to tell them that he's drunk and crazy and ready to use nukes so that they'll back down. Good cop, bad cop kind of thing, and that they really don't want a violent solution to this. What do you think?
I think there's a little bit to it. And it's funny, I've never been described as an optimist before. This is
well, on Ken Silverstein's page, you were the you were the most hopeful one there.
Well, the Iranians are getting more fearful, you know, of what is to come. And in fact, Ahmadinejad, who has enabled the United States to rally significant sectors, you know, of world sections of world opinion and government toward taking a tougher stance to against Iran on this issue, has been a catastrophe for his country. He's come under, in just in the last few weeks, a tremendous amount of internal criticism, most notably from the most conservative regime-affiliated newspaper in the country. And people don't realize this man, even though he's the president in a very jury-rigged government inside of Iran, he's not in charge. He wouldn't have his finger on the button, and if a decision is made to stop enrichment for negotiations or not, it's not his call. It's the call of the supreme leader, Khamenei, and his inner circle. But I would not eliminate the fact that the Iranians might do that, because they have nothing to lose, really. A little face, yes, but suspending the little bit of enrichment they're doing now for a few months for talks is more of a symbolic gesture than anything else. In fact, I was sorry to see the suspension of enrichment get into the UN resolution, because people really do need to sit down and talk. And there's no way for the Europeans to talk to the Iranians now, the UN, unless Iran suspends its enrichment. And it's a major, it's become a major obstacle, you know, to negotiation, even though, again, it's of only symbolic value at this point, because the enrichment, the number of cascades they have in funds, the number of centrifuges that are working, are minimal.
Right, and they had suspended their enrichment in the past when they were dealing with the E3. They only started again, what, a year ago, right?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Okay, and now, I'm sorry, I thought of one last question. I read an article in the Asia Times that suggested that the more you and I talk about the disastrous consequences of an American attack on Iran, that Bush has already discounted our concerns, he and Cheney have, but that actually what we're doing is making it seem to Khamenei that he might just be able to push his luck, that the U.S. is in no position to do anything, etc., and that we're actually making war more likely accidentally.
Well, I can't rule out any of that. You know, that's like the argument I hear all the time there, that any criticism of the administration's policy here in the States means, you know, that we're hurting the troops in the field and encouraging our enemies, this kind of stuff, when history tells us that by the time you're getting that kind of criticism, already the situation on the ground's degraded so far that you need to take a second look at it.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's possible, but I don't think so. I think that they're not looking at the critics. They're looking at him.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping, I really am hoping, that he scares them into, you know, suspending enrichment. Because if that doesn't happen, this thing could get very, very ugly along the lines that we've been discussing before.
Everybody, Wayne White, he's an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute, former deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia. Thanks again.
Okay, bye-bye.